Welcome to Continued Success. I am Justin Clue. You can follow me on Twitter at Justin_Clue. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. You can follow her at Liz Rocher. Happy Friday, Liz. It's not Friday, but I said it was.
I'm like, I don't think it's Friday. I could be wrong. I've been taking a lot of medication lately.
Maybe by the time this gets published, it will be Friday. But for now, it's not. And we're talking on it. So...
Welcome to Continued Success, everybody.
Baseball still not back, as you can tell, but plenty to discuss, as I'm sure everyone knows. You were coming in hot already on a couple of topics, but I want to start with the most, I think, near and dear to anyone's heart listening to this podcast, which is the vaguely Phillies news. I mean, it was announced as Nationals news, but it impacts the Phillies as well. In that, out of nowhere, it was announced that Kevin Franson would be taking over a role in the Washington Nationals broadcast team. A role vacated by, the spot is vacated by FP Santangelo.
It's a TV gig.
Okay, so it is actually Santangelo's job. Santangelo, of course, stepped away in November 2021 after a real bizarre back and forth suspension situation where the Nationals got him off the broadcast after an anonymous allegation was made against him on Instagram. Then he was back because Masson and MLB were like, everything's fine. Then more allegations surfaced. The Nationals were like, get him out of here. And then by July 16th, I believe, he was back in the booth. MLB and Masson had done their investigation, and they decided, no, he can be back. And then at the end of the season, after the season had ended in November, Santangelo, I believe, on his own volition, stepped away from the role. And that role now belongs to Kevin Franson, who had received nothing but high marks on the Phillies radio broadcast with Scott Fransky. That was a very enjoyable broadcast, and now it's just over.
God.
So it's not like Phillies fans won't not talk about the situation with the broadcast team. I know that in general, I think people have softened a bit on the TV broadcast. Well, on Tom McCarthy, not on Ben Davis.
No,
everybody still thinks Ben Davis is bad, and frankly, it just, you know, objectively, he is not good at.
No.
Being it, I don't know what, I mean, maybe Xfinity's just like, yeah, he's not going to cause any trouble, so whatever. Tom McCarthy, seems like a solid dude and a lukewarm broadcaster, and he's just the guy we have, and I think people have just kind of come to terms with that after the thankless context of having to become the next guy after Harry Callis in that role. And then the radio broadcast, I think you saw in the survey The Athletic just ran. They were like, what do you think about the TV broadcast? What do you think about the radio broadcast? TV broadcast had like the second highest rate of the people. It was like the majority of voters voted for like, it's okay. Like, I don't hate it. And the radio broadcast, of course, got very high marks, as it typically does. I think you can cheaply say because of Scott Fransky, not even Fransky in LA, because LA is not a full-time part of that broadcast anymore. He's last couple years, he hasn't gone on the road, he's pulled back a bit, so they did that whole revolving door of Kevin Jordan, Kevin Stocker, and Kevin Franson.
the carousel of Kevins.
All more or less auditioning to be Fransky's partner, and you know, I think at this point you got to say the common thread is just Scott Fransky is a terrific radio broadcaster, and that's why not that LA wasn't good as well, but I'm just saying the common thread there, I think, just tells you it's the Scott Fransky show, man, and he does a great job.
Yeah,
and
he did
a great job with Kevin Franson, who's, I think, the enthusiasm and the way they played off each other, they had a great dynamic. He was funny. Like, yeah, it was a good broadcast. It was different from the LA
very
broadcast.
Conversational.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a background in broadcasting. He's a baseball player. At least I don't believe he has a background in broadcasting. And so it was a rough start at times, but he learned quickly and was just so interesting and warm and willing to laugh, and clearly realizing that, yes, this is their jobs. Everyone's playing baseball for their jobs, but not taking it too seriously, knowing that it's not life and death out here, which I really appreciated, because LA sometimes takes everything way too seriously.
Yes, L.A. had gone from being a tiki bar fun guy to curmudgeonly, and I would say the Phillies kind of did that to him. When he joined,
we heard it. We heard it over the years. We heard it happen to him.
He was there for the glory years when baseball was fun in Philadelphia, and I think he had a great time. And I don't know, I have no knowledge of this. I just suspect, based on like what happened and how he sounded, that slowly it became, and then very rapidly it became, not fun to have your job be watch this team and talk about it every night. And he started to get a little angrier and a little crankier, and the team did nothing. And then I think he was like gonna step away, but then the team, like, things kind of changed a little bit, maybe like the Harper signing and everything, and the vibe started getting a little more positive. And I think he kind of, I've always suspected he kind of came back thinking like, maybe there's a chance we can recapture when this job was fun. I don't want to step away entirely. And he'd earned that. He'd earned that opportunity to like just do home games, because why not? People love Larry Anderson. However, I think what Kevin Franson brought was that like enthusiasm, like you said, conversationalism, excitement just to be there that you just didn't get from LA anymore. And that's why it was so cool to have him as a part of the broadcast team. And now he's not.
Nope.
So let's just kind of talk about the other aspect of this. And I commented on Twitter about this. Can the Nationals do anything that the Phillies haven't already done? Like, do they still think it's an insult to the Phillies? Because at first, when it was like, we're gonna sign Matt Stairs, we're gonna sign Brad Lynch, sign Eric Brantley, like all those little signings from those teams that they thought, I think, you know, we got Jason Worth, that they thought were like daggers in the Phillies, and it was
totally
like cool.
I totally forgot about that. Oh wow!
At a certain point, it just becomes like stupid loser shit, and yeah. Like that's kind of where we're at now. Like, come on, you guys won a World Series. By the way, their Twitter account still says the account of the 2019 World Series champion Nationals.
Wait, what? Their official Twitter account says that?
Yeah. So, like, at what point does this just is this full on stupid loser shit where they're just hiring former Phillies? And I gotta tell you, we're past it. We're there. Like,
yeah,
this is just lame shit. Like, God. And I'm not saying that's the only reason they hired Franson, but this is part of a pattern now that's been well documented that they just keep. And as I've brought up before, when you and I met for the first time, it was at a Q&A at a Sabre conference where Brad Lidge was answering questions. And I asked him if the Nationals, just about his experience and what they had him say and quotes he said after he had joined the Nationals. And he was like, look, they asked me to say some things that I refused to say,
yes,
because I still had family living in the Philadelphia area and stuff. Like, he was joking, but I think that part of it where they asked him to say, make a few comments, because there was a strategy of sorts in place. That this is not just like a conspiracy theory. This was like, I think this was at least partially, they were taking advantage of the fact that, hey, a lot of these guys were getting our former Phillies players. And that went on. Like, there were other guys other than the guys I've mentioned who were former Phillies that the Nationals just kept scooping up. And now we got, now it's Kevin Franson in the broadcast. Now they moved into the broadcasting booth. I at some point, like, don't you want to... You guys are World Series champions from just not too long ago. You have Juan Soto. Like, you have a history now, a little bit of a history now. The Bryce Harper days are over, but when Bryce Harper was there, he was huge for the Nationals as well. So I guess I'm just saying, at what point do you stop relying on this one-sided rivalry? And by one-sided, I don't mean one team's, obviously the Phillies beat up on the Nationals a lot. The Nationals were the better team for a while there. But at this point... Why is this little brother thing still going on?
It really does feel like the Nationals look at themselves, or the Nationals think the Phillies see them as the deformed little brother who lives in the attic. And in reality, I feel like the Phillies do not care or see them at all. Like, they're just like, we've been here since the 1800s. We've lost more games than you'll ever play. We've lost more games than you'll ever even play in the entire life of your franchise, guys. By the time you get to...
The earth will be over by the time.
Like, we've got, like, the Phillies, like, a rivalry at the Mets was different. They have a little bit more history, and there's, like, actual real competition there. The Phillies and Nationals have they managed to avoid being in direct competition with each other for the Nationals' entire existence. They've never been good at the same time. I think that's true. And so I feel like the Nationals, they might feel like they missed out on a chance to actually hammer the Phillies down, you know, really make them know that we are a real team. And even if they had the chance to do that, the Phillies would still be like, I'm sorry, and you are?
Yeah, it's just, I feel like I've made this comparison before. I remember talking to somebody whose job was being an NFL mascot, and he said he had tried to, you know, bring a personality to that mascot, and that personality he'd chosen was like way overconfident, like super cocky, kind of a dickhead, you know, like that was the humor he was trying to mine. That was the distinction he was trying to be. So he wasn't just like, I'm not just like part of this blur of NFL mascots that's been completely ignored and forgotten. He was like, I'm trying to stand out, and this is the personality I went with. And it feels like the Nationals are trying to do the same thing for a while there, where they were just like, we're being like super confident. And they always kind of try to do it like in like a cutesy way too. Like they want to be really cute about everything, but they also want to be like, no, we're going to be like the confident ass-kicking Nationals. And that kind of ended with the tweet from a couple years ago now, where they were like, beating Philadelphia isn't as hard as Philadelphians say it is. And then like, got their asses handed to them by not a very like solid Phillies team repeatedly a number of times since that tweet happened. And I think they just kind of like are ignoring that. And I do feel like they've pulled back a bit from that persona they were trying to adopt. I mean, now we're just talking about the Nationals, which is fair. But at the same time, this does kind of suck. Franson and Fransky were a great combination in the booth. And if this is still a product of the Nationals trying to, like, steal things the Phillies have, then, like, Jesus, we just give it up already. Like, this is not a thing.
The Phillies don't hire and fire these guys. I'm sure they... Right. It's NBC Sports Philly, fuck you, Comcast. They're the ones that make these decisions, and they should feel like they got by the Nationals. They really should. They should feel like they missed out, because there's no way. If any team offered Franson a TV gig, that he wouldn't take it. It's a
no
step
way.
Up.
Yeah.
It's a promotion. It's huge. It's huge. And essentially, he got to spend the last, 2 years auditioning for a TV role. And the NBC Sports Philly's lack of recognition of his talent, lack of desire to bring him up and make him a bigger part of the TV broadcast, find a way to incorporate him more, or tell him, yeah, we're gonna put Ben Davis in a trash can and float him down the Schuylkill. You could come in anytime you want. Like, the fact that they didn't do any of that to hang on to a guy who obviously has talent and who's Nationals fans should feel really lucky, because he's a great broadcaster. He's fun, he's interesting, and he's non-traditional, which I think is what a lot of people are looking for from their broadcasters these days. You know, from their color commentators especially.
And they're not going to be particularly good. So having somebody who can get excited about the team would be a boon, I think. And to be honest with you, I remember saying the same thing about Davis when he was hired to cover a Phillies team that wasn't supposed to be good and wasn't good. And the way that, like, he approached it as kind of a cheerleader and always finding positive things was like, oh, okay, well, this could work for us then. And after a couple weeks of that, you were like, shut the fuck up. Like, don't tell me, oh, this is great, when, like, this team is shitting the bed night after night after night. Like, just don't tell me that. We obviously ran into that a couple of times, wound up running into that with the manager telling us, like, something was happening that wasn't happening as well at a certain point. So I don't know what Ben Davis has done to get such job security in the Phillies TV booth, but it really doesn't feel like he's going anywhere anytime soon. And again, Tom McCarthy, you know, seems like a good guy. I feel like if he wasn't with the Phillies anymore, he'd still be getting broadcasting work, because we all know he does NFL broadcasts currently. I mean, he'd get work somewhere else. Ben Davis just isn't a good broadcaster.
No.
Like, he just shouldn't be doing what he does.
No. And I said on Twitter that the one thing that Ben Davis has in his favor is that he has a Philly accent. He's from Aston. So, like, is that it? Like, is that Is that really what it is? Do they really think that fans need to be comforted? Because he came in and essentially replaced Wheels, didn't he?
I mean, they had that, like, Stairs was in there. Jamie Moyer was in there. Like, there was a transition period, but neither of those guys stuck around for too long.
And, I mean, and Wheels had that powerful accent. And there are times when I listen to Ben Davis and I'm thinking, is Wheels here? And he's not. It's just Ben Davis. And that makes me think that there's someone at NBC Sports Philly that believes that there needs to be a strong Philly accent in the booth, which just couldn't be farther from the truth. No one cares. No one cares. You know what you should do? They should throw so much money at Jimmy Rollins to come in. Jimmy Rollins is already, this coming year in 22, he's going to be on a weekly baseball show on TBS. He's going to be doing, because that's part of their new multi-billion dollar deal, MLB's deal with TBS, because TBS is now taking a bigger role in broadcasting weekly baseball games, sort of picking up the slack that ESPN has dropped because they suck too. But, like, Jimmy's going to be a huge part of that. Like, they should be going after some of these guys. They should be trying to figure out who can we pick that the fans like, or at least know, that we think is going to be successful. And they just don't seem interested in doing that. They're just very eager to stay with the status quo and to shed money and people who are beloved. Like, Greg Murphy's not there. Jim Jackson doesn't do the mid-game anymore. Like,
They made Jim Jackson Flyers only. And yep. Murph got a gig, I believe, back. Like a, mm-hmm. I think a radio pregame show or something back. I mean, you know, if as Scott Lauber pointed out in his story in the Inquirer on this, the Phillies have not announced their 2022 radio and broadcast teams. And Scott Fransky's 5-year contract extension expired at the end of last year. So we don't know who's going to be in the booth.
No, I can't imagine Fransky leaving. I can't. He's a Texas guy, but he's been here for a long time, been here forever. And that would be, NBC Sports has to know, that would be heartbreaking. That would be, if I can't listen to the radio broadcast, that makes me less likely to watch a Phillies game. If I can't put the radio broadcast over it, that already makes me less likely to watch it. But, like, if there's no Fransky, that's a big problem. That's a huge deal.
Oh yeah. Like I really hope that clearly your assumption is there's never any bottom that a corporation like NBC Sports Philly won't sink to if they think they can save a buck. Or if, I don't know, somebody got insulted or somebody was viewed as too risque. So clearly, you know, they don't care. I've never gotten the impression that they care who fans get to listen to. They're just like, what makes us satisfied with this situation? So I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if, for whatever reason, a reason we never come to learn, Scott Fransky's not there anymore. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, this is curious. That line that Lauber included right at the end kind of brings new context to this. Like, all we knew this morning was that Kevin Franson had gone from the Phillies to the Nationals. But that kind of, that might be a ripple effect. That might be a sign of something else. Like, you don't know. Right now, we don't know who's going to be telling broadcasting our Phillies games in 2022 on the radio. So, or TV, really. So we don't know. We're talking about these guys like, they're here, but we don't know who's here.
No, we don't.
So
as much as we may not have a huge amount of confidence in the Phillies going forward, I don't know anyone who has any confidence in NBC Sports Philly to do the right thing.
Yeah. Nope. I mean, this is, again, the company that has listened to Ben Davis the last few years and been like, yes.
Yes.
Nothing to change here.
We like it. We want it. The fans are obviously wrong.
This situation is perfect. I think we can all agree. All right. Let's move on to what's really going on in baseball, which is, of course, the labor stoppage. Hey, Ken Rosenthal wrote another column. He also wrote a column on the international draft, or co-wrote a column on the international draft with Maria Torres. And on The Athletic. I did not get to read that before we started recording, but I think it was illuminating in some regards, as we were just talking about the international draft and problems with it, our issues with it, on the last episode of Hittin' Season. But he also wrote another column on the labor stoppage, which I believe it was Bradford William Davis kind of took to task and really illustrated the issues with, because I think the issue was Rosenthal is being clear, saying literally, this is not at the moment a both sides discussion. The owners need to acknowledge that the game's economic landscape has tilted too far in their direction, and that the sport's competitive integrity has been compromised by teams refusing to invest in their products. Commissioner Rob Manfred initiated the lockout, then was rightly pilloried for calling it defensive, and saying it was intended to jumpstart the negotiations, when in reality, 43 days would pass before the league presented the union with an offer on core economic issues. The union, meanwhile, is asking for across-the-board adjustments, seemingly trying to regain all that was lost in the previous CBA in one fell swoop. As written previously, a path to an agreement does not appear that difficult, which is one reason why, if games are lost, many fans will not care to debate which side is at fault. They will just turn away, disgusted by the tone-deaf vibe of what was once the national pastime. And I believe what Davis was pointing out that was like an issue with this, again, it's funny to watch these national writers, you know, the ones that respond to accusations of bootlicking, like try to, oh, no, I get it now, I get it. And then every time they come back with something, someone's like, well, and even if it's just one word, they're like, well, no, that's also wrong. Because the issue here now is Rosenthal is saying, well, people aren't going to care. Yeah, sure, the owners are at fault, guys, sure. But people aren't going to care who's at fault if they don't get baseball. And if the problem is that people are uninformed, and your job is to inform them.
Yeah.
You can't just report that they're uninformed and shrug. It's the both sides thing up to this point that Rosenthal has certainly been a part of that has had any that has any fans assuming that the truth isn't true. Like, it's objectively true that the owners like won the last CBA, that they've spent the last 5 years trying to take even more than what that got them, and now they want to take even more and are refusing to budge for the moment. They are the bad guys in this story. You don't have to feel bad for millionaire players, even though in the case of like minor leaguers and stuff, you're not always talking about millionaires. But to understand that objectively, the owners created this situation entirely so that they could take more. Like,
yeah.
And again, if you're not explaining that to people and they just think, well, everyone's at fault, then yeah, that's kind of on you, man. That's on your little foot in both camps, trying to stay vague until, you know, I don't know if Rob Manfred getting him cut from MLB Network is really like, oh, now I'm really gonna I don't know. God only, I doubt it, you know, like
that's the thing. Rob Manfred isn't his source. He's got other sources he needs to protect. And he can't do that unless he both sides it. And I just want to say that this whole saying that people are uninformed, ignoring the truth, and just not trying to inform anyone is endemic in all over journalism right now. Especially in politics, it's happening everywhere where they're just like observing. They think that's their job, is to just observe that people are uninformed instead of remember, hey, we're the press. Our job is actually supposed to tell people what is and isn't true. We're supposed to give them facts and inform them about things instead of just telling them they're uninformed. It's such a frustrating thing to see. It makes me want to ram my head into a wall. There's also an article today, Evan Drellich, who's usually pretty good about labor stuff, wrote, I mean, I found, because I'm very interested in this stuff, I found it relatively basic, but he wrote an article today about MLB's strategy in these negotiations, which is their goal is not to offer anything at all. All they want is to break the players. They're not going to offer anything serious until they absolutely have to, which is not going to be a while, which is going to be a while, because I think the players are very strong, but they're hoping that they can break them. That's what they want to do.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like politics, where the goal has just become let's hurt the other side. That is our goal. That's our motivation for doing anything. And honestly, in Rosenthal's defense, not that I want to, or that he needs defense, but inadvertently in his defense, there is going to be a subset of baseball fans, no matter how easily you explain something or clearly, they will not listen. They will not care. They have already decided what they think is true, and that's just going to be... And it's also just much easier to be like, well, both sides are stupid, and that's it. Like, if that's all you want to think about it, then fine. But it is objectively incorrect to go about it that way. Like, that's just simply not the situation. So, you can explain things all you want. Some people just aren't going to listen. They're going to be motivated by, you know, not listening. You know, they're motivated to keep things as easy as possible for themselves. But that being said, for him to say this is what people are going to think because they're just not going to know, and he's got this huge platform to say, no, this is what's going on. And he does, you know, to an extent do that in this column. But like I said, we got to this point media-wise because most national writers, all national writers are like not able to talk about this without worrying about burning someone on one side, typically the ownership side.
Yeah. I mean, that's where their bread and butter is. That's why these guys are hired, why they stay at their jobs. Why do you think, like, there are betting outfits right now trying to steal, like, Adam Schefter from ESPN. And it's because he breaks stories. All these big places want are people who break stories. They want people break stories. They want sources. And if you don't do enough of that, they don't want you. And the betting places are feeling the pressure because all of the people who have sources currently work for places.
Well, that's the job, it
or
being an
Darren
insider.
Revelle.
I don't understand what his job is.
He's worked for Action Network for ages. I still don't know.
He's just a dumb piece of shit. Like part of his stuff is like, look what a fucking loser I am. And he knows that he can get engagement by like playing one-on-one and like running a 50-yard dash or something and like looking like a dipshit little nerd when he does it. But then he goes on like his, I own a lot of Martin Luther King memorabilia. And you're like, what the fuck is wrong with you? he is diseased in his brain. He is a weird dude.
My favorite part of that was a tweet he deleted about offering his collection of signed Martin Luther King memorabilia, because that's what you do when you respect someone and understand their message fully, is buy things that they've signed.
To be able to brag about it online, that you own it.
Yes. He offered to loan it to the Smithsonian to show, and they declined, saying they would require him to donate it. And he's like, no, I bought it. Why can't you just show it? Why do you have to own it?
Why should I give it? I bought it. That was his argument. See what I mean? Just a dumb piece of shit. All right. Well, moving along. Why don't we take a break here? When we come back, we'll talk about an interview with the principal owner of the Rays and some sound bites he gave us that had our friend Liz Rocher crackling mad just maybe an hour before we started recording. After that, we'll talk about our two rebuild era Phillies of the week in Mitch Walding and Mark Leiter Jr. As we do every week on Continued Success, we reach into the mason jar and we pull out two names of former rebuild era Phillies and shine a big old spotlight on them. And we got some new information for you on Mark Leiter Jr., because that's what you tune in for, as well as Mitch Walding. So we'll get to all that when we get back right after this. And we're back on Continued Success, talking a little bit about a press conference held by Stuart Sternberg, a principal owner of the Tampa Bay Rays, where they talked about how Major League Baseball had killed the city split concept that was apparently still on the table, the one where the Rays were going to play part of their season in Montreal and part of their season in Tampa, taking advantage of people's desire to see baseball back in Montreal and taking advantage of the fact that nobody goes to Rays games. So perhaps putting the team in another place will generate greater revenue streams. Boy, I'm sick of hearing about revenue streams. Oh, I do not give a fuck. Nope. All right. So, Liz, this was a particularly annoying interview. There were plenty of sound bites coming out on Twitter from the press corps, the Rays press corps. A couple of things where somebody brought up the word betrayed, if he felt like he was betrayed by MLB. And I believe he said, betrayed, that's a word. And, you know,
certainly is,
Stu. Says he had the well, the team president, Brian Ault, told the Tampa Bay Times, to have the rug pulled out from under us like this is extraordinarily disappointing. This is a big old kicked puppy press conference held by the Rays. Yeah. And you found it particularly irritating in some components.
Whiny and stupid in every way. Really, truly. This man is a billionaire and is just whining. The MLB won't let me do what I want. The stupidest concept in the entire fucking world. The two-city concept is so absolutely dumb. And my least favorite part was his insistence that these partial seasons are the way of the future in professional sports.
Yeah, I have never heard anyone else say that.
No.
I have never heard that topic come up as like, yeah, get ready for this. It's like, you know, they talk about the DH. It's like, yeah, eventually it'll be universal. It's inevitable. No one has ever talked about a team playing in two different cities in the same way. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the first team to come up with that. And, you know, there's some obvious flaws, I think. Like, what are you trying to build a fan base in two different cities? Like, instead of giving Montreal a team, now they can just say, like, well, the Rays are our team because they play half the season here. So you're going to see, what, a bunch of people walking around in Rays gear in Montreal? And what, you're going to change the name of the team? Or, like, what is the long-term thinking there? It just seems dumb. It seems like something that the Rays would do specifically, not something that every other team has to do.
Yeah, like, the insistence that sister city plans will be the future for all sports is one of the most laughable things the sports executive have said, not ever, but in a very long time. Because when this first came up, there was no one saying that it was a great idea. No one was saying it was a good idea economically or from a fan perspective, from a player perspective, or a baseball perspective. There are no advantages to this for anyone but the owner. And in reality, the sister city concept, I personally believe they came up with it to try and blackmail Tampa Bay into giving them a stadium site that they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously what's going on.
That's
here.
All it was, and now he's just trying to be like, no, this was a serious idea, and now that we've brought it up, everyone is going to want to do it, except it's not a good enough idea for us to want to do it first.
He's a Wall Street investor, and it's such a Wall Street investor, like, what? Everyone's talking about this. It's like Tobias Funke at the water cooler. Like, everyone's talking about this Funke. Oh my God, it's on fire in the industry. Yeah, like nobody was agreeing with that. And now he just sounds like, yeah, you know, it was a really good idea and everyone was doing it and now we can't do it and it's not a good idea and no one is doing it. And that's just the thing that happened. And frankly, people would go to these games in Montreal because they want to go to a baseball game. But I don't think what Montreal necessarily wants is baseball back. I think they want the Expos back. Right?
Yeah.
Like, is that...
What is the team even called? What do you call it? The Tampa mm-hmm. Bay Montreal Ray Expos? Like, no. None of this makes sense. There's the fact that it's such a good idea, Stu Sternberg says, that it's the future. But it's not a good enough idea for MLB to do it first. Like, that is really the mind-blowing part of this for me. MLB wasn't prepared to go first is what he said. And he's still trying to get us to believe that this was a good idea, a real idea, an idea that anyone was serious about in any way. And it completely failed, not just because it was a bad idea, but because Tampa Bay refused to be cowed by this idiot.
They just, well, good for them, really, you know?
I mean, like, cities have been fighting back, especially ones with real shitty states. It's Oakland and Tampa, I think, are the two that are really starting to fight back because they've got teams with shitty stadiums that the teams refuse to upkeep or, you know, pay more money to do anything with. And they all they want is to find a new site. And the cities are being very resistant because, of course, when that happens, they're going to want tax breaks and money from the city and the county. And, you know, as many incentives and things that they can possibly get. And they don't want to give it because there's no benefit to giving a team money to build a stadium in your city or county. There's no benefit to it. There's just not.
You mentioned the concept of sister cities. You know, this idea, this is just off the top of my head, but like if you want to grow the game, I don't think necessarily splitting a team's schedule between two major North American cities is necessarily a great idea. But if you want to like have each Major League Baseball team pick a team, pick a place in like Britain or Germany or Australia or New Zealand where maybe they go and play a series once a year, that would probably grow the game. I mean, you got to work out the logistics, obviously, time zones and travel and all that. I'm just saying on its own, the concept is a bit more, I think, forgiving and productive than what Sternberg's trying to do with his, well, we can hold this whole city over a barrel and then get what we want.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he thinks that anyone would, any city would be like, yeah, let's split, let's have this team that we paid so much money, spend half of its already, you know, 82 home games somewhere else, is completely absurd. I will say that the NFL has done games in the UK for several mm-hmm. years now, and the stadiums, they play them in soccer stadiums, and they are completely filled to the brim.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Yep. They don't, just like baseball, football is not really a thing in the UK, but you bring it over there and you grow, like, I think they made steps towards sort of assigning like vague areas to different teams or something like that for like a handful. There's something that came out about that I think a couple of months ago, but yeah, like it can be done. You can grow the game. Like the game, they're so focused on trying to find more fans in the United States, which like baseball has been here forever. You're just not going to do it. Everyone knows what baseball is, and if they care, they care. If they don't, it's hard to get them to do it. Try going somewhere else. You know, they could really take advantage of getting MLB out in a place like Australia, where there's an actual serious baseball league. The Australian Baseball League is a thing. They've got teams, they play, major league players go there. Players from there have played in the majors. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be great. Like, they could do more with Japan, where baseball is incredibly popular.
Seiya Suzuki is, you know, huge, huge background at the moment narrative on the off-season MLB calendar this year. Juan Soto, one of the biggest stars of the game from the Dominican Republic. I mean, baseball is an international sport. It just is. You don't have to think stateside or Canada side to necessarily grow the game. And let's be honest, at this point, right now specifically, in no way do I think Rob Manfred and the owners want to truly grow the game. They want to grow revenue streams. They want to thicken revenue streams into robust robust columns of funding that are just girthy. But they don't care. I don't think they're, oh, we want to grow the game so more people can enjoy it in cities where it doesn't. No, they just want, you know, we know what they want. But that being said, yeah, there's a whole wide world out there that's either waiting for baseball or hasn't been introduced to baseball, and you know, you can take advantage of that. Like, I it's a missed opportunity.
The NFL is not an international game.
No.
It's not. And but they are trying their hardest to be there. They are trying to get, you know, it's about revenue, funding and all that, you know, money, but they are trying their best to grow the game of football in other places. Like, they're trying to grow the game of football so it's attractive to kids in the United States. I watched a Nickelodeon broadcast of the Dallas and 49ers over the weekend. It was the most fun thing I'd watched in ages. slime. Like, was it Nate Burleson was really fun. There was like Slime and SpongeBob, and like it was great. It was fun. Like young Sheldon would pop up occasionally at the bottom of the screen and tell you what something was. Like, you know, what is a neutral zone infraction? Like, that was great. And I'm thinking, this has been around for a year. Nickelodeon has had a weekly football show for a year.
Oh, wow.
Or almost a year. They started at the start of last season, of this past season. And I don't know about numbers necessarily, but they are actively trying to get kids involved with the, and, you know, a fan of the game of football. And the only way Major League Baseball thinks that kids can become fans of this game is by playing it. And they're not even trying that hard to get kids to play it outside of white privileged kids in suburban neighborhoods. You know, there's so much they could do. Like, imagine a weekly baseball show on Nickelodeon. Imagine one baseball game a week being broadcast, not just on, like, they'd have to have a deal with CBS because Nickelodeon's a Viacom company, but they could do broadcast one game a week, have kids do it. Kids who like baseball, call the game. Make sure there's slime and stuff. That would get even more, that would get adults who haven't watched baseball in a while to watch it.
Get kids, get a kids broadcast. You can keep doing the stat nerd cast if you want. I don't think I've ever tuned into that.
Never.
But just because it's not my thing doesn't mean it's not somebody else's. And then you know what? Do the opposite of a kids broadcast and do an adults only broadcast where they can say shit and fuck and he hit the fucking shit out of that. Just like do one of those, like online only. Who cares? Exactly. Like that also would be funny. Get like Artie Lang on there or something. Like get comedians to come on.
The NFL got close to that this year with the Manning cast. Monday Night Football. That's as close as they've gotten to that. And I'm positive that what you've described is in the future for the NFL. Because it's what people want to hear. It's why they listen to podcasts and certain types of serious shows. You can say that stuff. And
one time I was at a friend's house and their parents were there maybe last year or 2 years ago. They were talking about the fact that I'm on these podcasts with you guys, and the dad like left and then he came back and he was like, oh yeah, I just listened to it when I left. Like, I was like, oh my God. And he was like, I love that you guys curse and stuff. He's like, I hate like the restraint and like there's at certain times like a fakeness to not being able to just say literally whatever you want in that like people are like restraining themselves or finding ways around. He's like, it was just more fun to me that you guys were like just mm-hmm. fucking going off. I was like, oh, that's an interesting note. All right.
Yeah. Like the NFL has their alternate broadcast on Monday nights. Be the Manning brothers and whoever it is they find to come on. And it's been a lot of big celebrities and big names. And MLB decided to put one of the best broadcasters in the game, a guy whose name I do not remember, and one of the least inspiring non-broadcasters of all time, Mike Petriello, that's what their alternate broadcast is. They're like, you know what? People really want stats. They don't want fun. They want more stats talk. Like, all MLB does is try to find more ways to make the game less fun. Like, they say, at one point, they said they need to get young people in the game, because they do, because the average age of their fan is like 108. But everything they do is geared towards an older audience, but a reserved, conservative audience, completely ignoring that millennials are the loosest generation that's ever been born. You know, before whoever the hell it was behind us. But, you know, we're definitely
Gen X.
Oh, I meant the younger than us. They are certainly a lot less inhibited than we are. But
Gen Z. Yeah.
Yes. Gen Z. Like, we're certainly less inhibited than Gen X and boomers. And everything they do is geared towards the fans that will be dead in the next 20 years. And when we're older, I don't think that's what we'll want. We won't want the things that they're trying to sell to the older audience. That's not what we're going to want. We're not going to want to stop swearing when we hit 50. We'll only want to do it more.
Yeah, if anything, I'll be doing it more.
Seriously.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we close up here, we got to get to our rebuild era Phillies of the week. As I said, we got Mark Leiter Jr. and Mitch Walding for you folks. Liz, you took on the Mitch Walding legacy. Would you like to tell us what you found?
Absolutely. Now, did I start this thinking that Mitch Walding was a pitcher? Did I write the first several paragraphs of this still thinking he was a pitcher? You cannot prove that. He is a third baseman, which is something definitely know now and did, of course, know earlier.
Actually, you know what? I might have thought he was an outfielder until just now. That's true.
He could have been anything. He had a total, I think, of 13 at-bats with the Phillies. Or no, 19 at-bats, 17 plate appearances, a handful of games. He was born September 10th, 1992, in Lodi, California, which is, I've been told, a place you can live. The only thing we know about him from then until he attended high school is nothing, except the fact that he survived and made it to go to high school at St. Mary's High School in Stockton. And by his senior year, he was very good at baseball. In his senior year, which is 2011, he batted .442 with a .584 slugging percentage. And he was also a pitcher. He went 6-1 with a 0.63 ERA.
Well, see, you weren't wrong. You weren't wrong at all.
Yeah, I had gotten that far and thought, oh, I was right, he is a pitcher.
Case closed.
I saw that and I'm like, oh, good. Then I realized that no, that was not true at all. An article from the local paper written in late June of 2011 in his senior year talks about how Walding's untimely foot injury nearly ruined the team's entire season.
He was that central of a role. Yeah,
apparently.
Okay, I see.
The St. Mary's Rams had a rough start to their season that year, but they were just rounding into form with an 8-game winning streak when Mitch Walding broke his foot. At the time, he had absolutely no idea how he'd done it. And to this day, he probably still doesn't know. Here's a direct quote. Can you tell me, just from this quote, what he hurt? He had some soreness prior to a game at Stockton Ballpark on April 23rd. During that game, when Walding pitched a gem in a 1-0 win over nationally ranked Archbishop Mitty of San Jose, the soreness quickly turned into serious pain.
That could be anywhere on his entire body.
Yes.
What breaks in your foot when you have a broken foot? Just anywhere in your foot?
Yeah, like there's a bunch of tiny little bones in your foot.
Oh, okay.
They're all small.
Okay.
So here's this quote directly from Walding, which still doesn't tell you what. This is the first, this is how they introduced the injury, talking about the injury and not telling you what it was. I honestly don't know what I did, Walding said. It was sore, but it wasn't a big deal. By the second or third inning, on one pitch, I pushed hard off the rubber and I really felt it. Again, could have been his arm, his leg, his toes, his nose. Doesn't it matter?
Does anywhere in the article specify that it's his foot?
They do. It's not until the middle of the next paragraph that they even say that they reveal what he'd injured, which was his foot. He went to the hospital after finishing the game. After pitching a complete game shutout, he hurt his foot in the third inning. He was like, yeah, I'm just going to finish this game. Fine.
Toughen it out. No wonder the Phillies drafted him.
Yep. The healing time.
Can't believe the Flyers didn't draft him.
No. The healing time meant he was going to miss the playoffs and probably never pitch for his high school team again. But his foot apparently didn't agree with that because less than a month later, he was pitching in the playoffs.
That's that young man's energy.
Yes.
That's that young man recovery where you're like, well, I didn't wake up dead. So clearly I'm capable of anything.
Yes. The article notably doesn't mention anything about being medically cleared by anyone with a degree in medicine. But he did play.
Who wrote this? Where did this appear? Some backyard newsletter?
It's one of those USA Today owned papers now where you cannot tell where it's from, the real name of the paper. It's the Record Net. It's the Record.net or the Record.net.com, something like that. It is an actual paper in 2011, at least. It was an actual paper. So he did pitch in the playoffs. He got a hit in each of the he had a hit and scored a run in each of the Rams' 7 playoff games, and they won the playoffs. At that point, Mitch had already been drafted in the 5th round by the Phillies, but he'd also been given a full scholarship to the University of Oregon. That could not have ended up mattering less, because Walding chose to play in the majors instead. He'd signed for $800,000, but also made a deal with the Phillies that they would pay his future college expenses. As of this moment, I don't believe he's using any of that money. He is still theoretically pitching, though definitely not in the majors. So Walding spent 6 seasons in the Phillies minor league system before getting his call up. He did not have great numbers in the minors, but also you don't need to have great numbers in the minors in order, I guess, to be named like with the mid-season Eastern League, being named to the mid-season Eastern League All-Star team. He hit like 230. Like 235. I was very confused.
A strong representation that year in the Eastern League All-Star game.
Yes, indeed. In his first 4 years in the minors, he hit between 220 and 240. He finally figured out Clearwater pitching in 2016, and he hit 280 when he was finally promoted to Reading, where he hit 214 for the rest of the season.
Isn't Reading a famously good place to hit? Like,
yes.
To the point that people are like, oh, we got to factor that into like our scouting that maybe a guy who's good there isn't super good. But Mitch.
So this is where he was a midseason Eastern League All-Star in 2017 with Reading, which I found interesting because he hit 209 through 50 games in Reading's, but he also hit 13 homers in 25 games in June. So that probably had something to do with it.
Is he funny? Like,
I know. That's my question.
No, I'm sure he was worthy of the honor. I don't know anything about his defense. The one thing I remember about Mitch Walding is something I think you're going to get to closer to the end of this summation of his exploits.
Indeed. So there's my document. 2018 was Walding's year. He hit 266 overall in the minors with 20 doubles and 19 homers. It was all for Lehigh Valley. He made his major league debut in May and ended up being one of those dudes that year the Phillies constantly called up and sent back down. He played in 13 games over 4 different stints with the club that year. He started just 2 games. The results overall were not great. In 19 plate appearances, 17 at bats, he hit 059, 158, 235. He had just 1 hit, which he didn't get until September, which was his 4th stint. As of this writing, it remains his only major league hit.
And what was it, though?
That's a good
one. What was his hit?
I don't remember. Was it a home run?
It was a 2-run home run.
Oh, see, I was just going through the baseball reference charts, and I did not look that hard. That was my mistake. Thank you.
That is what I remember. I remember that game. It was Brian Holliday, a catcher, was on the mound for the Marlins by this point. Don't get me wrong. This is a game the Phillies won 14-2. So that's partially why Mitch Walding, I think, was in there as well. Carlos Santana had started at third base. But Mitch Walding was put in there for a late game at bat. And I remember John Kruk just being like, come on, Mitch, because it had been
too.
So long
that
he just hadn't had his hit. And everybody knew this guy's not sticking around. Like, this guy's not he's not an answer. He had never really been considered one. It was just like, yeah, we need guys. We need guys to finish out the season. This was the middle of September in a year where the Phillies were not going to the playoffs, even though they were 75-71. So they might have still been thinking, chance, but in any case, Mitch Walding was not considered a prospect, a top prospect, or even like, you know, potentially a guy. He was just a guy playing down there, and they brought him up. Just could not get his major league hit. Just could not get the bat on the ball solidly. Struck out a lot.
Yeah.
And then finally, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there is a fun fact about his major league debut. Do you know it?
No. But I kind of know the ballpark it might be
yes,
in.
Yes, you do. He was the first Phillies player ever to earn a golden sombrero in his major league debut. And the sixth player in history, in MLB history, to do that. Four strikeouts in the game. I just want to say I was momentarily offended when I was looking at that the image that goes along with the golden sombrero entry on Wikipedia had Ryan Howard's image attached to it until I looked at the entry and realized that he is the MLB all-time leader for golden sombreros at 27. Now, the now retired Chris Davis had 26, and I think if he'd played a little longer, he would have had it. It would have been
easily. That's probably why he retired. I'm not doing that. Yeah.
He appeared very, very briefly for the Phillies in 2019. He struck out in his two lone plate appearances in the majors. He barely hit above the Mendoza line for Lehigh Valley, and they designated him for assignment at the end of the season. He signed a deal with the Blue Jays in 2020 and did not play anywhere. I can't find information on why he did not, but he has no stats for that year at all. He signed with the Angels in February 2021. And yeah, that's it. That's where he was. He played in the minors last year. He was again. You see. Oh, no. Oh, is that the... I think he played in the rookie. He played in the rookie league, or maybe the Arizona league. I'm like, wow, he hit 500. Oh, wow. It was with rookie players. Oh, wow. He hit 238 for Salt Lake last year.
Well, you know what? Every single human being on Earth has a ceiling to their baseball playing skill. And Mitch Walding's is certainly far higher than ours.
Very true.
But it also seems to be right around that rookie league level. Yeah. Seems to be where his ceiling is. And that's just how it goes sometimes. Now, before we finish up, I'll run down my Mark Leiter Jr. legacy, who was the other Phillies player that the Mason Jar decided we would talk about in this episode. Instead of going back over, you know, seasons as we've done on this show, we're just going to reach into this jar and pull some names out. One for this episode was Mitch Walding. This other one is Mark Leiter Jr., who I think people are probably a lot more familiar with than Mitch Walding. There is a picture in the March 13th, 1992 edition of the Tampa Tribune of a little boy in a fluffy white winter coat being handled by his mother and his uncle and being handed a sandwich for him to take a tiny little bite. Meanwhile, on the field, there was Mark Leiter of the Detroit Tigers pitching in a spring training game against the Braves at Joker Marchant Stadium. That little boy with his sandwich would one day be the pitcher on the field, and we can assume that other children and other sandwiches would one day be in the stands surrounding him. That would be his legacy, you might say. The legacy of Mark Leiter Jr. I have a theory or a suggestion, perhaps. After doing some, you know, doing this research, obviously aware of Mark Leiter Jr.'s father playing Major League Baseball. He played for the Phillies, among other teams. And Al Leiter obviously also played professional baseball very well. The Leiters might be the first family of baseball. I'll say it. We'll get into this. In May 1997, Mark Leiter Sr. was now pitching for the Phillies. But on May 16th, he didn't pitch very long. According to Kevin Roberts in the Camden Courier-Post, Mark Leiter Jr. was only a few minutes late to his father's start against the Astros, along with, you know, his mother. He was not alone. But he missed his dad's entire night. Leiter Sr. had lasted one-third of an inning, and the Phillies lost 12-7 to Houston. His whole appearance took 11 minutes. Leiter met his family in the tunnel to explain he was actually done for the evening. Said about his son, "He gave me a hug after beating me up. He's very mature for a six-year-old." Leiter Jr. was all around baseball in the late 90s. As I said, his dad and his uncle Al were both major leaguers. On July 12, 1997, they became the seventh pair of brothers to face each other in baseball history in a game. Reporters loved to pull Mark Leiter Jr. into the story every time he was like around. Once he was quoted at 7 years old when his dad walked four Mets batters in the ninth inning and said, "That's okay, Dad. I walked six in one inning this year." When Senior was recovering from what could have been a career-ending injury, it was a game of catch with Mark Leiter Jr. that made him think, you know, my arm doesn't actually feel that bad. And that, like a moments later, his son asked him, do you ever like want to play again? Like, do you ever think about playing again? And he realized that yes, he did. And he got back. He started getting back into shape. Made another go at Major League Baseball. In the early 2010s, the stories on Mark Leiter Jr. stopped being about the precocious, sweet little boy in the stands while his father or uncle pitched, and started being about the effective New Jersey Institute of Technology right-handed sophomore who was named the Great West Pitcher of the Week in May 2011, or how he threw a one-hit complete game shutout against the New York Institute of Technology with 11 strikeouts in July 2012. I assume that's a huge rivalry. Or when he struck out 20 guys in a game in May 2013, including the last eight batters he faced.
Holy shit.
The last eight. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's nuts when you're real tired. And he's a kid, so he's thrown eight gazillion pitches.
Yeah, I think that was his senior year of college. So, like, man, he was, I don't care what level you're at. That's impressive. Is an accomplishment. 22 years after that picture with the sandwich, that little boy would be drafted by the Phillies out of the baseball factory known as New Jersey Institute of Technology in Toms River. Pitching for Lakewood in 2015, pictures of Mark Leiter Jr. were now a full adult in a uniform with a mustache. He'd never been considered even a prospect by Baseball America and the like, but that's probably not uncommon for 22nd round picks in the MLB draft. He was touted for his baseball IQ, for how he attacked hitters during an at-bat, and for his lowish velocity. Nevertheless, he quietly made his debut for the Phillies on April 28, 2017, in Los Angeles against the Dodgers. The Phillies lost 5-3 with Michael Saunders. Can't wait till we pull his name out of the jar. With Michael Saunders getting the last at-bat of the game. It ended a six-game win streak. Wow! Leiter Jr.'s debut was noted in the game recap and nowhere else in the Inquirer, though they did point out that Mark Sr. and Mark Jr. were one of two pairs of fathers and sons to each play for the Phillies. I'm sure you can guess the other pair.
Who are they?
Liz. Who is the other father and son who played for the Phillies?
Am I having a stroke? Oh, my God. You know, I'll tell you, three quarters of the time, I forget Ruben Amaro played baseball at all. He was a bat boy in 1980 and then magically appeared as a GM or an assistant GM executive in the Phillies organization. That middle chunk of time might as well not exist for me. I forget he is a baseball player constantly.
This year on The Dirty Inning, we will be celebrating the 30th anniversary of Ruben Amaro's Phillies playing debut, just so you know. But in any case, Mark Leiter Jr. was with the organization from 2013 when he was drafted until 2018. There's not much to latch on to in regards to his career. He pitched for the team during two forgettable bullpen years in 2017 and 2018. In 39 games, he made 11 starts and finished 7. So the Phillies dropped him in anywhere that they felt like it. I'm sure that did nothing for his development. Mm-hmm. But he had risen through the farm system since 2013 and worked with various coaches and various players. But in truth, he was with the Phillies for far longer than just those years. What we can latch on to with Mark Leiter Jr. is the fact that he's one of us. He grew up a big Phillies fan, and even in 2008-2009 was urging his dad to get tickets and go see their team in action in the postseason. In fact, in his debut, he got to pitch to none other than Chase Utley, who was now a member of the Dodgers, a man he had idolized as a youth and who he'd watch win that World Series almost 10 years before. Wild.
Wild. That's great.
Mark Leiter Jr. doesn't appear to have played professionally stateside in 2019 or 2020, but this past season he was in the Tigers farm system, pitching at the AA and AAA levels. He played in 25 games and made 19 starts with a 3.77 ERA. But this past November, another young man was taken in the Major League Baseball draft, this time by the Rangers. He went a little quicker than Mark Leiter Jr. went, going with the second overall pick to Texas and getting an almost $8 million signing bonus, the largest for a pitcher in 10 years, according to the Associated Press. His name? Jack Leiter, son of Al and Mark Jr.'s cousin.
Wow.
He was 21 years old, and he had tied for the league in strikeouts in NCAA Division I baseball for Vanderbilt. So I'll say this about the Leiters. they just keep on coming.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to argue that the Boones are kind of a big family in baseball, but they haven't been producing new players.
This is what I'm talking about. When I saw that, like, oh, a lighter nephew has just been drafted by a team, I was like, good Lord. I mean, Mark and Al Leiter are from, you know,
a billion years ago.
a generation ago. And then Mark Leiter Jr. was from ours, and now they got Jack Leiter. I mean, that's three generations of Leiters who just keep going into baseball and making it to its highest level so far. So, yeah, I mean, that's impressive. It is. You know, there's other more famous, like, obviously, there were two Griffies that played and multiple Ripkins. That's probably a good argument, actually, to make the Ripkins. But still, it's a lot of guys from one family to play professional baseball. So, hey, I think it was worth mentioning.
Agree. Completely agree. Good stuff.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Continued Success.
You want to pull some names out of the mason jar, man?
I was going to do it.
Were you?
No. As always, we got to pull some new names out of the mason jar. Let's see what we got here. Reaching in the middle. Next week, we will talk about, oh my God, I have no idea who that is. Ricardo Pinto.
Oh God.
Absolutely no idea who that is. And the other name will be Kyle Garlick. This is one of the first truly bizarre combinations of people, I think. We had, remember when we had Brandon Workman and Heath Embry?
That was great.
That's bullshit. But these guys all seem to be like related in some ways. But these two, I really don't remember Ricardo Pinto. I really don't.
The name rings the bell. I could not tell you what either of them looked like. I couldn't tell you when Kyle Garlick played. It sounds familiar in that maybe he played in the last couple of years, but.
Yeah, he's a more recent one. Yeah.
One of the many nameless, faceless players that the Phillies churned through their system like chum. Chum to a bunch of sharks.
And on that note, we will end this episode of Continued Success. As always, thanks for listening to this show, as well as all your favorite podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness, The Dirty Inning with myself and Trevor Strunk. And if you go over to the Patreon at patreon.com/hittandseason, Chris Jones and I, our most recent episode of Absolutely Hammered was a live stream where I had a few drinks and berated Chris while he played a game called Super No Crying in Baseball. Which is a computer game where you try to hit the ball as it's pitched to you while maintaining control of your emotions as your dad watches you play.
Oh,
so we got into it, and that was a lot of fun. So that video is now available on Patreon for subscribers for $5 a month. We'll have more content up. Liz and I will have another movie review up before the end of the month, and there will be another episode of Absolutely Hammered as well. So you can look forward to all that as baseball continues to figure its shit out. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.